Welcome to 10 Frames Per Second, a podcast about photojournalism by photojournalists, but for everyone. With your hosts, Joe Giordano and Molly Roberts. New episodes drop every Tuesday on 10fps.net or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also catch back episodes on WLOI.org, as all episodes are recorded and produced at WLOI Loyola Radio in Maryland.
Well, welcome back to 10 Frames Per Second. Locally, it's been a pretty wild news couple of weeks. There was some event yesterday. I'm trying to remember what was it? I haven't seen any photos. It wasn't very well documented in the back of my mind.
It was just everywhere.
Yeah. Anyway, so the eclipse, right? Anyway, thank you for tuning in. That we're finished. So about three weeks ago, March 26th, The Key Bridge in Baltimore, the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, was hit by a tanker and collapsed on contact. I've never actually used the word shock and awe because of its connotations, but when you woke up in the morning and saw the video, it was pretty shock and awe. For those that are not from Baltimore, it was a major artery for transporting things to Baltimore, to the port, and it was also part of our major shipping lane, which now is closed. So our guest today is Caitlin Newman. She is the managing photo editor at Baltimore Banner. She's been in photography for over a decade.
When I was 17, so a little bit longer than a decade.
So with Baltimore Sun, Baltimore Business Journal, BuzzFeed News, and others. And welcome, Caitlin. She's been covering the bridge pretty much nonstop, almost from moment one.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And Molly is by proxy today. You're in North Carolina.
Doing some very intensive cat sitting.
Oh, there you go. Calm down. Well, if you have to run, let us know.
Okay. If they start jumping.
Yes. Yeah, definitely let us know. So, Caitlin, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hey. So, just talk a little bit about how you got started in photography. We use the S's first, get it out of the way, and then we get into the real stuff about what you do.
Yeah, sure. So, I've always done photography. When I was a kid, we had those disposable Kodak cameras, and I would just take pictures of my friends, my family, and my dad, and I would sit in the parking lot of Walmart and eat McDonald's while we waited for the 1 hour photo developing to happen, and then we would look at all my pictures. And then when I got to high school, you know, you could take photography as an elective, and back then, you know, we still learned in the dark room. We still had to process our own film, and if anybody here who is used to doing that is listening, dark room in a bag. That was a thing. You put your arms in the bag and do it by feel. That's how I learned. And I really liked the process, and I thought it was a lot of fun. I was a painter before that. And then photography was just something that I enjoyed as an outlet. I was an editor of my high school newspaper. So naturally I just would take pictures. And then when I got to college, I was actually a poli-sci major, and that ended real quick. And I remember, well, I always really liked journalism in high school. Let's give it a whirl. And that's kind of how I ended up with a journalism degree. I went to grad school for journalism, and I just kind of climbed the ladder in terms of smaller publications, the larger publications, back to community journalism. Kind of a quick trip around the sun of my career.
you're a current teacher. You teach photojournalism.
Yes,
is it Photo One or Photojournalism?
So I teach both Photojournalism One, and I recently piloted Photojournalism Two. Nice. So it's the same class I took as an undergrad there. Monica LaPasse taught me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
And she was the same age I am now when I was teaching that class. So it's kind of a funny full circle moment. But yeah, I've been teaching there since 2020. My first class was the pandemic kids.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, no. On Zoom.
It was, you know, I usually would be like, you can't use your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your mom. And when that happened, I was like, you know what? Do what you can.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was teaching on Zoom too. It was sort of horrible, but yeah, all the rules sort of fell apart at that point. just take pictures, anything.
Yeah, just do your best.
So you went, you were at the Sun for a while, and then this new publication popped up in Baltimore.
Yes.
You want to talk a little, because you've been with them from day one.
Sure. So I got my start at the Sun as an intern when I was in college still. And then I became what's called a permalancer, which just means you shoot just like staff, but you're not on staff. I left there to go to the Business Journal. I left the Business Journal to go into, I was a military journalist for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. not enlisted, but I worked for them as a journalist. And, you know, the Baltimore Banner popped up. Emma Harris is somebody that I knew from The Sun. And she called me one day and was like, are you still in Baltimore? And I said, yeah, what's up? And she said, well, we're launching a new newspaper. And the Banner was actually a paper, I believe, back in the 70s that they resurrected after attempting to turn The Sun into a nonprofit didn't work. So that's how the Banner came to be. And I haven't been with them since day one, but I started shooting for them May of 2022.
Right. That's like day one for visual, right? Because they had all their writers.
They had all their writers. They had hired another photographer whose name I forget. And then Yuli Muniz was on staff. And it was pretty much just him shooting. And then they brought me in as a permalancer on a weekly basis. And then October of that year is when I left the military and took staff.
What's the biggest difference working for, because their model is very unique to the news industry. What is it like, the difference between working for like a for-profit publication and a nonprofit publication, or is there no difference?
There are differences. So I write as well as photograph, but I'm not a consistent reporter. Like, I don't write every day. So with me, my experience, I would say, is mainly in the visual arena of things. With, you know, when I was at The Sun, like, I was allowed to do things that I wanted to do, and a lot of my pitches were accepted, but because it's a print paper, you can't print 36 pictures for one story. With the Banner, I feel like I have a lot more leeway in visuals and how I'm able to utilize them and how I'm able to use the space of the digital atmosphere that we have and really give visuals the spotlight that I feel I wasn't able to do in print journalism. And also with the Banner, I do feel like I've been able to take the time to go a little bit deeper on stories. I wrote a story about bereaved mothers becoming friends, and I took 3 months to work on that. I don't think at any other publication I would have not only been paid to do that and spend that much time on one story, but encouraged to do it as well. And that came out really nice. So,
right. Cool, because the work's been, I mean, you worked on a lot of, we've had quite a lot of news here since you started at the Banner.
I feel like that's always for Baltimore, though.
Yeah.
I always tell my students, I'm like, listen, if you grew up here, like, you're lucky if you're going into news, because Baltimore is such a city that's so dense with stories and diversity and just so many different things coming from people that, you know, I've lived here my entire life. I've moved to Montpelier a little bit. I lived in Orlando for a brief stint, but every time I've come back to Baltimore, I learn something new. And I feel like it's such a gold mine just for human interest stories, for learning things. And I always tell my students, you know, you guys are in close proximity to so much stuff here.
But I was just chiming in to say, I think that Baltimore is a really eccentric city, and I think that makes it more interesting to cover it. For instance, I lived in D.C. for a long time and was very involved in the news world there, and it's a lot more about politics. It's a lot more dry, and like you know, what I'm seeing in Baltimore is just a feast. And when I see your website and see all of the crazy events like Hunfest and, you know, those things don't happen in D.C. or a lot of other cities. So it's great that you get to dig into the eccentricity of the town as well as the news events, which this one was a big one and, yes, and an unbelievable one. Can you tell us like how it started and how it ran as far as covering that Key Bridge disaster?
Yeah, sure. So I'm somebody that always has their phone when loud when I go to sleep, because no one's going to be calling me unless it's an emergency at 3 a.m. And I actually had my alarm set for like 5 a.m. because my whole team was supposed to be in Philly on Tuesday for journalism conflict training. And so I was already planning to wake up really early, and my phone started ringing, and I saw it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was my editor, Emma. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. And she had hung up, and I was like, okay. And then she starts calling again. So I'm like, I pick up and I'm like, are you okay? She's like, I'm okay. Key Bridge collapse, get up. And I'm like, I'm sorry. What do you mean? So what, for like 5 minutes, this poor lady is trying to explain to me what happened. And I'm like, but what do you mean? And she's like, it is gone. And, you know, I cover this community and I live here, but I'm also living this too with the people that experience this. I come from a long line of the men in my family being iron workers, blue collar steel workers. So a lot of the men in my family have worked on that bridge. They've worked on the Bay Bridge. They still do. Fort McHenry Tunnel, Hanover Street Bridge, all that good stuff. So this was something that I felt directly affected me a little bit more than it just being a bridge collapse. It was just something in Baltimore that was the backdrop to my whole life. And then in 30 seconds, it was just gone in the middle of the night at that.
Yeah, it was so surreal to see that video. I mean, it was just unbelievable, like some kind of CGI film nightmare or something. But
a lot of people thought it was fake. They didn't think it was real when they first saw it.
I can see how they thought that.
Yeah.
I sort of thought that too. I'm like, what? I was thinking, because you're a Baltimore native, like you're sort of uniquely prepared to know how that bridge is going to affect the people of Baltimore's lives once it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have probably only gone under that bridge in a boat I don't think I've ever driven over it. So I don't know that part of town.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, continue. Tell us the whole story of, like, what did you do then?
So I got dressed and I went out. My partner was actually awake at the time, and he comes running downstairs. He's like, "Did I just hear you say the Key Bridge collapsed?" And I was like, "Yeah, do you want to go?" So he jumps in the car with me, and you know, he was such a big help because was the driver while I'm in my car trying to do logistics. You know, you open the map and I'm like, all right, where are some points of vision that I can get to that I can photograph this? And I hit a couple spaces, and then I kind of just waited for the sun to come up to get a clear shot. And there was a moment when I knew where the bridge was. So I took a picture, but it was so dark that I had to brighten it after I dropped it on my computer. And that's when I really saw it.
Yeah.
And I was, oh my God, like this is a big deal. And I got my team finally started waking up around 5:30. And I had everybody out. I think we were all out by 6. And we remained on all day coverage, I want to say, until like 8 o'clock at night.
Wow, that's a long day. Well, do you guys still use like police scanners and stuff like that? How did you know what was going on? And
so by the time I got the news, a couple reporters had already been in tune for it. I can't remember exactly who saw it first. I think our reporter Elisa saw it first and was like, "Oh my God." And that's when, like, you know, all the editors started trying to wake anyone and everybody up, and 5 of us were awake. So we had like a group huddle, and I got a lot of my information secondary from reporters that had been awake before me. And then with logistic wise, I just kind of looked at a map and dropped some pins, and I was like, I'm going to try each of these places until I get blocked off. And I knew Fort Armistead was going to be blocked off, so I didn't even try there. Rivera Beach, that was pretty open. That's where I took the first shot from. And then they had
where to go. I mean, because you're local, you knew where to go. I'm sure like reporters who were sent from DC were sort of like,
how to get access to this? People there, and they were all texting me like, where are you? Where did you go?
Did you do a mix of video and still?
Not the first day. Mm-hmm. When I didn't do video until I actually got on the Coast Guard ship, which is a whole other story. But when I got that access, you know, it was just me there. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm gonna take some video clips, and just I really wanted to show people what it looked like up close, because it is it's bigger than you can imagine when you're right underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was doing some research, and you know that Fort McHenry statue?
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's 24 of those laying down. That's how long it is. So to put that into perspective at how massive this container ship is.
Yeah, those ships are pretty huge. Big when you roll up on them. I've been out there with a pilot.
They're huge.
Realize it till you're right next to it.
Even the containers are the size of like a tractor trailer.
Yeah.
And there's hundreds of them. So, I took the video because I was like, I want people to see what this looks like. Photos, they look cool, but I feel like you can't really tell how big it is. And we use that on our social media, on our TikTok and our Instagram.
So can you talk a little bit about your editing process? I mean, you're taking hundreds, because you're covering this for
Yeah.
I mean, for at least for the first 2 days, you were intense down there. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you found time to edit and the process of editing, like what you were looking for to get this story down?
So like most photojournalists, I think in a tight, medium, wide narrative. I want to show the wide shots because I know I need at least one of those to show the environment and the scale. And then the detail shots, I want people to see the crumpled containers. I want them to see the name of the ship. I want them to see the damage done to the ship. And, you know, when you look at those little detail photos, you can get more stories out of what you find in looking at those visuals. And then just your medium shots just kind of set the scene. And so in my head, when I'm shooting, I'm like, all right, that's my wide, that's my medium, that's my tight shot. And then when I will usually Bluetooth it to my phone, and I already know like in my head what frames I'm going to upload. So I don't really do any more than like five at a time, especially if I have Kirk on standby to grab photos. I'll drop them in our Slack channel and I'll say, here's the caption, adjust as you need. And then I kind of just drop them in. Usually when I get some downtime, I actually just got the coolest thing. It's called a wheel desk, and you just put it over your steering wheel and your laptop can sit on it. And it has made editing great.
I don't know if that's
specifically for photojournalists, right? I mean, who else needs a wheel desk?
Cool. I think I've gotten in the past like few months. But when I get the time, I will sit in my car and I will wheel desk it, and I'll be able to take a little bit more time on some, you know, toning stuff, like more complete captions, stuff like that. But it's very hit or miss with me with time.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of which, when you're talking about toning, Molly, you had some questions regarding AI. I know Caitlin's kind of on the forefront locally of putting the word out there as far as in social media, and I'm sure you teach it at some level. Yeah. And I think Molly, you had a couple of questions about
that. Yeah. I was looking at some of your personal work, and you had a tutorial on your blog about your use of AI, or how to use it to enhance musical photographs. And I was just wondering, can you use these kind of AI tools for your work at the Banner, or is that sort of verboten?
So it's not tools, it's just one tool, and that is denoising. And what, you know, noise in your camera is something that's a byproduct of your camera. It's not something that is in the environment of what you're shooting. So if I'm shooting something at 12,000 ISO, because I have to, because it's pitch black, I'll denoise it and take away the noise. The only AI part of that is that it just automates it for you instead of me having to go in and hand remove all of that noise. But that's the only AI tool I would ever use.
Yeah, I was curious just because I spoke to this, you know, professor who was researching AI in photojournalism, and he said a lot of people don't realize that just using filters on iPhones is using AI. You know, there's a lot of sort of, I guess, messiness when it comes to sorting out the difference between personal work and photojournalism. And I figure you probably talk to your students about that if you're teaching photojournalism at Towson. If you were just teaching photography, then it would be sort of like, okay, yeah,
filter away. Yeah. So
with the divide.
The filters and stuff, that's not allowed. I don't allow that. One, mainly because it's not accurate coloring. It's not how it looked. And also I quite frankly think they're ugly.
especially like boosting up the contrast, and then what the hell is this?
Flattens an image. It really flattens it. Like when I look at somebody's feet, so when I'm looking for a freelancer and I need somebody, I don't really go to their website because I don't have time. So it's like I'll go to their Instagram and I'll scroll through, and I can always tell when it's filtered stuff because it gives a very flat appearance. And I don't like that. It's just not my style. At the Banner, where we do not use filters. The only AI thing that we use is the denoising tool. But other than that, there's no filters. There's no, even if I use a prism, it has to be, you know, said that was used.
Yeah, I figured you're pretty much following along with sort of MPPA rules. Yeah. And if you wanted to submit any of that stuff for awards, of course, it'll get kicked out immediately if they figure out that you're, you know, using AI or altering it. beyond what their criteria allows or whatever.
It's getting scary. I've seen some like news Instagrams and I've been like, wow, this person's really good. And then I zoom in like in the background and there's like something a little wonky. Mm-hmm. But the foreground stuff is getting better. The fingers are getting normal.
Yeah. So. That's going to be pretty scary for Mrs.
Yeah, I think, didn't Adobe say they were going to make special tools that would be, you know, make it easy to find out if things are AI or not?
I think so.
All this deep fake stuff and all of these changes aren't really making it a challenge. And what I feel like people don't need more of a challenge to trust photojournalism or journalism than they already have, you know, so. But how to control it. Actually, next week we're going to have an AI photographer on, but he's like blatantly AI and you know, he's an artist.
It's not a photographer. He's not, you can't have an AI photographer.
Digital artist. I think I've seen AI stuff look really cool. Like I've been like, whoa, that's a cool concept that you created visually. But my fear is that in the journalism industry, that visuals are always the first to go. And I'm worried that it'll become a standard where they can do AI and it'll just be, this is a digital illustration of this event. And by putting that in the caption, they'll say that it's ethical, right? And
that's horrible. I hate that.
That's coming.
My worst case scenario is that it'll become acceptable as long as you say that it's AI and the general public for the most part.
I think it's okay with photo illustrations that might be for, you know, a magazine or a feature story, but for news, no. You know, how could any newspaper get away with that considering the kinds of, you know, ethical standards that they're supposed to.
Once people get used to it though, they're going to get used to seeing it. Like we watched a commercial last night that I'm convinced is AI. Like the whole commercial it was for a travel company. Because this woman ate a sandwich, like no human eats a freaking sandwich. I'm like, that is AI.
Union.
Nobody eats a sandwich that way. And then the more you look at it, the more you could kind of tell. And it's a shame that it's going to creep into our, you know. But I mean, you're in the business. What can news agencies do to prevent this creep? I mean, there's steps that, you know, I guess they can take to identify it. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't going to really talk about this, but since we brought it up, like World Press, right? No, like, so, no, I submitted because my publisher, mm-hmm. when we put the book out and everything, so I submitted. And I got to the semifinals for my category, which is long-term project. And then I got an email saying I couldn't go any further because one of the pictures that I had submitted had a black border around it. And the only reason was I accidentally used one that I had in the book because we had borders in the book. And then I used that one and I was like, for real? Like, just write me and say, do you have one? No borders. Like,
did you artificially create the border or was it from print? No,
it was just a canvas size, right? It was just a thin black border for the
on my Instagram.
Yeah, like exactly. It's just a little frame, right?
Picture.
So you got disqualified for that reason?
I didn't go any further. They said it would have been out of me and the person that won for the series category for the long-term
project. Wow. Sorry about that, Joe. But yeah, they're super strict. Like even sort of some digital spotting sort of stuff has disqualified people that I know. So you're not alone.
So I don't know how they're going to deal with, I mean, that's what I'm asking. Like what, you know, you're a teacher and, you know, you're in the industry. What do you think news agencies can do? And just in your opinion, we're not putting it all on you.
Yeah. just uphold their ethics, like make sure the freelancers that you're hiring and the staffers that you're hiring are news people. There's a very big difference between a photographer and a photojournalist. And it's interesting because when I teach my class, right, my class is open to, you know, it's an elective. So if they have instructor consent outside of the mass comm major, which I will usually give, you know, they can take the class. So I'll end up having photo students, journalism students, and there's like the rogue PR kid in there. And it's interesting because the photo students always know their way around the camera, but they can't give up the control. So they almost, that's their challenge in the course. My new students, they're always getting the moments, but they're not too savvy with a camera. Mm-hmm. But I always find my journalism kids produce better work, even if it's blurry or overexposed or whatever, than a lot of my photo students do.
So you have them all adhere to one rule so that you're not like dealing with all of these different genres essentially.
So in the beginning of the course, the first assignment is to go out and take some smartphone photos, mainly because it's the camera that's always on you. And I can see without fancy gear what everyone's eye is. And then I can kind of get, every class is different, right? Like I can get a kind of an understanding as to what speed I teach this class, because I don't want kids who are super proficient getting bored, and I don't want kids who are not proficient feeling left behind. So that's the first assignment I do. I kind of assess, oh, okay, this is what y'all can do with an iPhone. Like we're all about the same way of seeing here, or we're vastly different. And that will kind of change the sales of the course, if you will.
Page, yeah, I like that. I'm going to steal that.
That's AI. There you go. Just take it. Don't even credit her. Just take it. Like, oh, I collect a lot of phrases and put them all into one phrase. You know. So yeah, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your work as a teacher. Can you tell us a little bit about what your curriculum is, what your syllabus looks like? Because the history of photography is vast, and I have a teacher at my school who she teaches art history, and she loves using the term defunct history because she we stop teaching old beardy white guys as much as we can, which unfortunately is like the beginning, but there's all, you know, Margaret Cameron stuff. So how do you navigate that? Can you tell us a little bit what you teach?
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure people will come for me for this, but I actually don't really teach too much of the history. I teach more about the journalism skills you need to be able to shoot like a journalist and not a photographer. So like I said, we start with the smartphone assignment. I kind of get a feel of where everybody is in the class visually, and if who has the eye and who might need a little help, you know, and then we'll do just your typical assignment. So it's, I think we start with a portrait first. And the thing is, it has to be somebody you don't know. And I want it to be somebody that has a variety of motions. I want the mood to be different. So it's usually portrait of somebody you don't know, environmental portrait in their space. So let's just say you pick a glass blower, you know, you want to take their portrait in their studio. You want to take some of them doing some candids, you know, think of it as a feature profile. My photo two class does this, but they also write a story to go with it. Mm-hmm. So photo two, there's more writing involved than there is in photo one. Photo one, we're just doing photo. The next one, I believe I have them do, I think it's sports, and they learn action, reaction. They learn how to document action, reaction, tight, medium, wide. Let me see this game, but let me see the emotion in this sport. Then from there, we go to general news, and that has to be something, that's when they learn something that's happening that's timely. Everything else before you can kind of do whenever, and it can be published whenever, but news is something generally that happens in the same day that you shoot it, so it has to be turned in that day, because the following day, it's no one cares anymore. And then after that, we'll do feature, which is, you know, human interest. It's an evergreen. It can be published anytime. It's not as crazy as filing general news immediately. And then we'll have a midterm, which for photo one is a photo story. So that's about 12 images up from 8 images for each assignment. And then the final, they have 7 weeks to do. And it's the final, they have 7 weeks to do, and it has to follow a journey of something. It doesn't have to be something sad. It could be something happy. It could be somebody journeying to try out for The Voice or something like that. But it has to have some type of climax. And the reason I make them do that is because I need them to understand how to consistently work with a source, not just for one day, but to do that more long-term work. And the skills in that are vulnerability, accessibility, you know, how do you learn how to deal with the challenge of a source just ghosting you for a few days? What do you do if you show up and there's really nothing to shoot? Like, how does that work?
Which is often.
And then photo two for that midterm and that final, they do a package. So instead of just the 12 to 15 photos, they'll do, I think I have them at 8 to 1200 words and a 3 minute long A roll B roll video and their photos. So they'll have
so they start doing video as well.
Yes. And it's simple. It's just on a smartphone. I don't require any type of in-depth stuff. But the reason I make them do that is because when I'm out on assignment, sometimes a reporter can't come with me. So not only do I need to have the skills to photograph something and show the news aspect of it, but I might need to get a quote from somebody. I can't publish a story with just photos. I need to have some context. I need to know what's going on. And being able to juggle interviewing and reporting with taking photos, that's news, especially in an industry where the newsrooms are getting smaller and smaller. If you can do all of those things, you have a better chance. And with the video clips, that's important too, because I didn't know if we were going to do anything with the container ship videos I took, but our editing team put something together and we're on our way to 2 million views on it.
Wow. Is that on Instagram or is that on TikTok?
Yeah, that's on Instagram. TikTok bit 500,000, I think.
Wow.
But it's definitely the best news source for the complete coverage of
the social media is huge. And again, that's very visual. And I like it because it's bite-sized stories where, you know, you don't have to sit and read something. You can listen to it. You can watch it and get the general gist of it. It's free to watch. And also you have to take into account that it's also an accessibility thing. Like there's a lot of people in Baltimore who can't read, who can't comprehend, you know, what the story is saying. But when we break it down very plainly and very bluntly and very well organized on these 2 minute long TikTok videos or Instagram reels, everybody can understand what's happening.
And do the photojournalists have to produce all that? Are they like 100% one-man band? Or do you have a social media team? I know everything's contracting in photojournalism, so it's requiring a lot more skills for people.
We have a great social media team, a very tiny team, just like our photo team is very tiny. But usually I'll just send a bunch of clips to one of the social media team, and they will have it edited and ready to go within. They're very efficient within like 20 minutes. Like yesterday we did the eclipse. And so I was at the Science Center for the viewing party. I took a bunch of clips. I did a quick 1 minute interview with the observatory manager. And he told me all about the telescope and how they were using it. And then I got some B-roll of people looking at the sky, and it took me, I don't know, 5 minutes, but I was able to send that all off and our social team got to work. And then like an hour later, I was at the zoo observing the animals, and I had to get the lion losing his marbles over the eclipse, which was
what animal did respond poorly? I didn't hear that.
The lion. So the eclipse was around like 3:15-ish. And so they started doing things that they would do at bedtime. It was really wild. They started to do, and he makes this noise and he patrols, and he started, as soon as the sun started being out of view, he started doing all his bedtime stuff.
Making coffee, putting a tea kettle on. He's like, oh, it's late.
Taking himself in.
Taking himself in. Waiting for his wife to come home because she does all the work. He just lays around all day, you know.
So, yeah. Lion lost his marbles over it. And we were, so I was able to get the, oh my gosh, I forget her title. I think she's like the zoo curator. And she did a little on camera, 1 minute long clip of her explaining like, this is his normal bedtime routine, but because of the eclipse, he's doing it at 3:15 in the afternoon.
It wasn't totally dark, but was it a challenge visually?
Did you shoot the actual event? So that's an excellent question. We usually don't get into gear, but Molly, it's a great question. Your filters, though, can you talk about shooting an eclipse?
I didn't use a filter. I just did it and hope for the best.
Dears me.
So I knew we had decent cloud coverage and that my sensor would most likely be safe doing that.
I fried a sensor yesterday.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I had an old digital camera but I'm not cutting cable off. But.
So you wanted to see whether it would fry it or not?
Well, I'll let Caitlin finish it.
I was using a 200 lens, so I wasn't like right up on the eclipse. You know, it's not super big, but it's in the clouds and you can see the whole thing going on. And I just did it for like a couple frames and I was like, oh, I can still see and my camera still works. So I think we're in the clear. But I did have a freelancer. He did a very, Eric Thompson. I sent him to Patterson Park yesterday and he did a very cool composite. And his filter, he got a solar sheet. He managed to get one on time. And then he just used some gaffer's tape in the cardboard box it came in and just strapped it around his lens. And
that's wild.
Perfect. Yeah.
That's perfect. Yeah. The picture, fantastic. I think Brenner got up in a plane or rocket or some.
Yeah.
The budget for the Washington Post is insane. We need a rocket, you know. Like they had an airplane for the bridge collapse. They rented an airplane.
I'll be on a helicopter soon.
Well, there you go. We tried to watch it through the LED screen of an old digital camera that I had, and I was like, I'm just going to stop all the way down and see if I can get it. And it was towards the beginning, and it just fried it.
Like, so what?
Yeah, like it, you take a picture now, and it looks like the cosmos. I'll take a video of it. It was an old Leica that we had. It was like an early digital. No, it was. It was. I know it may be subconscious, but no. It was like their first digital, like from 2003 or 2004.
Okay.
It's like 1 mega.
That's why.
Yeah, I was like, and it just like blew the sensor, but the kids loved
now
it.
Now you have the Eclipse in every single picture you take from now on.
Forever. Yeah.
Well, we don't use it. That's why I grabbed it. Right. I'm like, this one that we don't use for the school newspaper because it's so old that this
files are so small.
You should
make a video of that. I think people would be interested to see.
That's a good idea. Like you have to, I know, and I'll put Year of the Lion in.
Hey, I wanted to go back just to the Key Bridge thing for one more minute, which I'm curious about the human interest stories that are unfolding from there, because you can only photograph a fallen down bridge so much.
Tell me about it.
Right.
So there has been a lot of community interest stories ranging from just the traffic patterns to the victims that were impacted by that and their families to the port workers who haven't been able to work since this happened to people wondering, is the Bay Bridge safe? Is the Hanover Street Bridge safe? And like questioning the infrastructure of the city that they drive around in every day and haven't really thought about it until now. My favorite human interest piece by far from any news outlet was one that we did. And my colleague, Jessica Gallagher, she's another staffer. She lives in Dundalk. And, when you watch that video, you see this truck go over the bridge and less than like 10 seconds later, it just collapses.
Right. Was that the two workers who actually?
No. So when I first saw that video, I was like half joking, like, I want to know who that guy is. How crazy to drive over a bridge like that. And then seconds after you make it over, it just collapses. So we were thinking, it was 1:30 in the morning. Who would be driving over that bridge? What would they be doing? Working, probably. And it's like, you wouldn't be driving a truck like that to a bar. You wouldn't be driving it to, And she was like, well, there's a bakery near my house that, maybe he works there.
Wow.
And she went to it and it was him. And that was verified by police having the license plate through the Easy Pass. And they actually called him to make sure he made it across.
Wow, that's I was wondering who that person was too. That's amazing.
We did a whole story on it. It is a man who works at Herman's Bakery in Dundalk. And the funny thing about it was he didn't even know it collapsed. He said that he was listening to Sirius XM really loud, driving across the bridge, and he didn't really even know anything happened until people started calling him in the middle of the night. And speaking of community, so crazy. My mom reads the story. And she calls me and she's like, oh my God, that's Larry. And I was like, who the hell is Larry? And she's like, that's my cousin Michelle's husband. And I'm like, what?
Is that for real?
Yeah. And so I was like, all right, mom.
Oh, your mom's a great news source. Forget about the police tracking down the guy in the truck.
I think the lead's kind of buried here on that story because they have the best strawberry shortcake in Lake Maryland.
I need to go. I've never been
there. Yeah, I think I either brought Jess their strawberry shortcake or told her to go have it because it saved their business in the 50s.
Oh.
And it's a total Baltimore thing. It's not the two biscuits put together. I went off the topic. It's called Herman's Bakery. But they make everything there. All the donuts, all the cakes, everything
is made there. He was up at 1:30 in the morning.
Everything is still made there. It's a family business. They've been there since the 30s, I want to say. They started in Highland Town and moved. They were going to go bankrupt, and then they found this family recipe for strawberry shortcake, and they still make it, and it's really good.
There you go.
That's a Baltimore thing I'm going to have to experience.
Yes.
That's my
Bridge Younger makes best strawberry shortcake. Should have been like that.
You have to wait until the bridge is rebuilt to get over there. I don't know how to
get over there.
Get over there.
It's Eastern Avenue. But that was my favorite human interest piece just because it was so specific. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I know everyone was like, well, who's that guy that made it over the bridge? And, you know, it was just using good detective journalism skills. And we got that. And I think the poor man's been like completely like buried by news requests ever since.
Yeah, he's got to get a publicist now.
Yeah. Oh, but that story by far has been my favorite one. And then one of our reporters is also doing profiles of the victims too, which I think is so important because it's all bridge, economics, engineering. But at the end of the day, there's still men under there. That they have not been able to get to. And that's all I think about when I'm out there. Like I think to myself, you know, I'm on a grave site right now.
Yeah.
And I think every time I publish anything about the bridge or I even show images of it, I will link back to a story about the victims, or I'll say, you know, three men still have not been recovered or something of the sort, because I can't imagine if that could have easily been like my dad or my grandfather or my uncle or my cousin. And it's like, I can't imagine if I was in that situation reading all this breaking news, all these pictures of the gravesite of my loved one and it not mentioning them, especially if they were still under there. So I think that's where local news is a really, really shines in something like this, because you're a familiar face in the community. You're living the event with the people who are reading about it. You're not just here for 2 or 3 days and then leaving. I think that the community aspect of this is where local news is the strongest.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, you immediately, if it's your community, you immediately think about the people who were killed, the people, you know, at filling potholes in the middle of the night, you know, and then families who their income's taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I read that it was mostly Mexican and Central American workers, I thought, you know, I hope people will recognize, you know, it's always good to like bring back that like a lot of these immigrants that people like to denigrate are actually just like so important to the little things that we need to continue to work as a community or a society, you know.
And you also have to understand that these men, you know, it's not like you apply for citizenship and then you get it in 2 weeks.
Right.
It can take decades to get it. But, you know, they come to this country to work, to provide for their families. And because of the citizenship blockade, they're not entitled to workman's compensation or certain insurances. So I actually went to a press conference that CASA held where they had several construction workers there who shared stories about having injuries so bad they couldn't work anymore, but they're not compensated for it because of whatever red tape or reasoning for who they were working for. Their wages are not the same as their American white counterparts. Simply because of their immigration status, but they're just as educated and they're just as experienced in electrical construction, painting, steel, whatever it may be. And that's a problem.
Yeah. And so I was really happy that, you know, the city and, you know, the governor and the mayor and everyone was really talking about that issue, you know, and talking about helping the families whose breadwinner is suddenly gone, gone in a terrible accident. So I'm sure that provides a lot of fodder for your coverage.
One of the most heartwarming things I got throughout our coverage was so many emails and comments and DMs of people asking, how can we help? How can we help them? So we did a whole story on just like what GoFundMes were legit, you know, what was approved by the families. And I believe that Highland Town, there's community organizers there that I've covered multiple stories in the community with. And they told me that within, I think it was 4 or 5 hours, almost 100, just shy of $100,000 was raised. And they actually ended up turning it over to the mayor's office so they could handle it on a larger scale. But it's going to be divided up between the six families.
Yeah, I saw that newspaper story. Yeah, amazing. That's wonderful. And then just it sort of piqued interest in workers, because I noticed I was at the Broadway Market, and the diner there was making sandwiches for all of the sort of people who are working on the trying to unravel.
Oh, the first responders. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's cool to see Baltimore pull together so well.
That's one thing that I've learned about the city and being a part of the city, is that it's Baltimore has like its quirks and its scaries, but at the same time, the people here are so supportive. Like, I read a quote that always makes me laugh, and it's like, people in Baltimore are mean, but they're nice. And people in the West Coast are nice, but they're mean.
Oh, that's
the way that translate is like, you know, you get a flat tire in LA and somebody's just like, oh, I'm so sorry, I wish I could help you. And then they leave you there. Baltimore, you get a flat tire and they're like, God, you're so stupid, let me help you. And I read that quote and I thought it was so funny because it's so true.
Are you you doing any personal work? Do you have time for personal work?
Yeah.
Working on personal projects that you can talk about or you can't really?
I can talk a little bit about it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's up to you.
So I've been working on a story since November. About a man who, when he was a Morgan State student back in the 90s, he shot and killed somebody. And he ended up going to jail for 19 years and 7 months. And this October, he'll have been out for 10 years. And the most interesting part of his story, he's an amazing person. He's extremely intelligent, and he's been so open with me through this whole process. And the interesting thing, like, you know, we've got into where he grew up, Baltimore, and grew up in West Baltimore, and his dad was in and out of jail. And so there's pictures of his father holding him in jail, him holding his sons while he was incarcerated, and then his four sons and some of them holding their own kids while they were incarcerated. So I have this very visual depiction of this linear generational trauma that has come from this. And what I've been doing now is he actually will take his grandkids out just to, like, they do, he's a photographer, so he teaches them photography. They have a little podcast. I actually hung out with them at the park last week, and they were just the cutest, coolest little people. And you know, he keeps them close. And he says that when he was growing up, he was raised by his grandmother, and her way of loving him was pushing him away. You know, mm-hmm. Don't come back to the city. Don't, because he went away to college and before he transferred to Morgan. And he said, you know, don't come home. I'll pay you not to come home, because she was so afraid that, like, he would fall into the same things that his father did. And he says to me, you know, my way of loving my grandkids is keeping them close.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a full circle story that I've just been working on. And his one son recently got out of prison a few weeks ago, and so they're rekindling their relationship. And
I'm curious about whether, like, prison services or Maryland's or somebody who, like, can come in and prepare people for going back to society from jail after being there for so long.
And so this is a huge part of my story. This is a huge part of my story. So, like I said, this man is extremely intelligent. He had never been in trouble before this. And when he needed help, he knew how to ask for it and still never received it. So I have letters that he wrote to the corrections asking for therapy, he said, you know, I have a lot of issues with anger. I really want help with this. I have letters from 2005, 2015, 2000, you know, all the way up until his release date, and him getting constantly denied of that help for 19 years.
Yeah.
He said they gave him like a 15-minute therapy session before they released him. That was all he got. And he, like I said, he's very intelligent. He knows how to ask for the things that he needs. So where does that leave people who don't?
Right. Well, so that's definitely
part of this story.
Yeah, it's so important because, you know, I mean, what do we expect if we're just warehousing people? How do we expect them to come back into society and break some of those patterns? So that's a That's a really important story.
So this man has kind of taken it upon himself to do that. So when he was incarcerated, he had a lot of workshops and mentorships. And when he was incarcerated, this was like the beginning of the drug trade in the prisons and the gangs in the prisons. It was like mid-90s. And so he actually would shepherd newer kids coming in and saying like, hey, you don't got to join this gang. You don't got to do that, you know? And then as he was incarcerated for longer, it was just mentoring, workshopping. And now that he's been out for 10 years, he donates his time to Parks and Rec. He has workshops. He's going to do a summer camp. And he's been doing this steady since he was released 10 years ago.
Wow, he sounds like an amazing character. Are you going to make a film too? Or is
no,
it?
No, I wish. I would love to. But right now I just, yeah, this is all just me. We hang out. It's very informal. And he'll tell me some things. And then I take note. I'll take pictures when I feel that it's appropriate to demonstrate something. So I don't really have a published date of this.
The banner will be.
Yes, the banner will have it. I recently talked to his son on the phone because he was like, you know, do you want to come hang out with me and my son? And I'm like, only if he's okay with it. And I don't want to feel like I'm intruding, or I'm very conscientious of the vulnerability and the access. And I will only be there if I'm welcome there. Like I cover a lot of funerals and vigils, but I'd never do it if I'm not explicitly invited. So that's how I am as a journalist. And that's how I feel best ethical practices are. And his son got on the phone. He was like, hey, Caitlin.
I'm sure he'd heard about you, right?
Yeah, the banner seems to be a good place for long-term projects. Yes. Are there other photographers there working on?
So just Jessica.
Yeah, well, I wasn't sure. I didn't want to discuss anything. Jessica.
So we have Ulysses Munoz. He is mainly our sports photographer, and he's been doing a lot of politics this season at the State House. We have myself. I cover a lot of breaking news. I'll do feature stuff. I'll do more vulnerable, intimate things that I have to handle with a lot of like care. And then we have Jessica Gallagher, who is an amazing journalist, but her skill is more long-term project stuff. Mm-hmm. So she'll shoot daily stuff if I need her to, but she has been exclusively working on a long-term project here in Baltimore that can't talk about, but it should be out soon. I'm very excited for it. It's a beautiful, beautiful project. I'm very proud of her for it.
It's going to be awesome. I know it is because we talked, but it's awesome.
Have you seen the photos?
We're meeting for lunch. Ooh. So we're gonna look at them.
They made me tear up a little bit.
Yeah, we're going to have her on here for that project.
Great. Good. Good.
Molly.
Well, great. Yeah,
it's with another organization also. It's like a joint, right?
It is.
Yeah, yeah. It's just really big. So it's going to be cool.
She's been working on it for a little over a year.
Yeah.
So it's going to be cool. It's a big deal. And then we have a fellow from Pointer, Kylie Cooper, and she has really come into her own since we got her last August. Her just shooting confidence and just her style of shooting, I've gotten to witness just completely elevate since her first assignments with us. And she unfortunately leaves us in July. I know, I'm very sad about it.
People get to be a fellow at the Banner. I'm sure there were a lot of people that would love to.
So I don't know. So she came to us and she was like, hi, I'm with Pointer. I have a fellowship with them, and she could pick the newsroom. And because there was a lot of buzz about what the Banner was doing, and, you know, the New York Times and WAPO and all these different places had done write-ups about the Banner and about how it's supposed to be like, you know, the air quotes future of journalism, or, you know, the experiment that everybody's kind of optimistically looking to. She read about it and she approached us. So there wasn't really like we didn't put out a signal for it. It was just Pointer offered her a fellowship, and
that's super cool. Sounds like it ended up working out really well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's been great.
Speaking of quotes, I read this on your website, and you said, I view photography as another instinct, another sense, and another extension of my body. I thought that was cool because I always sort of think there's a bit of just instinctual.
Yes.
Either you have it or you don't have it sort of aspect of photography. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. I joke with my friends that it's my spidey senses tingling. And I think once you've done something for so long, it becomes just like another sense that you have, and mine just happens to be visual with a camera. There's sometimes I'll just be sitting there and I'm like, feels kind of weird right now. Like, I think I can't explain it. I think it's just because I'm so in tune to the community that I've reported on for so long that I kind of know when things are afoot and when things aren't right or something is about to happen. It's just a vibe. And I couple that with things that I already know about what's currently going on in the city, what current events are happening. You know, protests is a good way to illustrate this sense I'm talking about. So we were at, I cover some stuff in DC sometimes, and we were at SCOTUS for, oh my gosh, I can't remember if it was a women's march or if it was like a, no, you know what? I think it was a women's march, and it was very docile, and people were outside of the, you know, Supreme Court with their signs and their demonstrations and stuff. But it was, you know, I don't want to call it lame, but it was very mild. It was very mild for what they were protesting.
No, people with signs don't really, you know.
No. And it was like people taking selfies and stuff. It just wasn't, you know, what I thought that they had set out to do. And all of a sudden, I just got this weird feeling. And I was with my partner at the time because he wanted to come see. And he was like, are you going to stay here? And I was like, no, I feel like something's going to happen like really soon. I was like, let's just wait it out a little bit. And I sat down on the curb and I was like, I just feel like it's about to happen. And then around the corner comes like 2,000 people just really ready to like mess it up for the day. I was like, there you go. I don't know. I just,
perfect. Yeah. Well, you
started that kind of stuff too. So, you know, sorry, I just used the JM. No. Joe shoots that kind of stuff too. Yeah. So I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. You were there for the inauguration, right? In 2016, too. I think I'm down there.
God, yes.
Yeah.
I hit under a car.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about working on the Hill?
I have.
Because I always see you like in that fray, you know, like
I have. And, you know, photographing the top political figures is, it can be a little glamorous, it can be a little cool to just get that because it is history. Like, those are the photos that a lot of times are going to be historical, and I like the idea of that. I like the idea of watching that circus. But I have friends that do that, and they're very creative in how they shoot, and they're forced to be that way because they're shooting the same thing over and over and over again. And so I can only do that stuff once in a blue moon. Like, when Biden visited on Friday, it was an absolute like madhouse. We didn't have a press riser. I didn't get there early enough to tape off a spot because I just didn't. And I ended up shooting between some other guy's legs on the ground to get the shot I wanted. And it's, you know, the shots are fine, but it just, that's not what really feels fulfilling to me.
Yeah, when it's just
ride on the plane and whatever, but this is where I feel like I have the most impact in the skill set that I have.
Whatever, you don't even have a silhouette shot of the president on Air Force One.
I know,
out the gangplank. Come on, I know. Are you even any good?
No, I don't. I did see the coolest political. I wish I even knew who this photographer was. Maybe he'll hear this and message me. I don't know, but the coolest political picture I ever saw was a glass window pane or something. It was shot with a low aperture, and there was all these like water droplets on it.
Kenny Holston.
It wasn't Kenny.
Really?
It was not Kenny.
One of those.
But it was Trump reflected in each raindrop. Yeah. So there was like 20 Trumps in these raindrops on this.
Doug Mills. Isn't he like Trump's favorite photographer, Doug Mills? It could have been Stephen
Crowley. I wasn't Doug Mills either.
We had Stephen Crowley on the show, and I always thought that he was really amazing in getting images that no one else was looking at. If people were, I've heard that people would say, you know, they'd be there sort of stuck and be like, oh, where's Crowley? What's he doing? You know, something different.
Some of the frames that those guys pull out of sitting there for hours, like you're kind of forced into it. And I'm like, man, like, how do y'all see, like, you know, I'm always so impressed by that political coverage. Like, one of my best friends shoots on the Hill, and, you know, the stuff he gets, I'm just like, man, that is so cool.
Tim Bremer.
Yeah. I was like, that is so cool. And I don't know. My heart is just not in that type of coverage. Maybe when I'm a little older, I'll give it a whirl, but
I get it, but it sounds like you're really doing some great work and really digging into a community that really needs to have somebody you know, people care and report deeply about.
That's the stuff that I feel most fulfilled doing and why I got into journalism. So I want to keep on keeping on.
Well, thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Caitlin. It was really great talking to you.
This is fancy.
Yeah. Okay.
I like sitting in the studio with my WLOY.
I know. Yeah. Molly's more in the studio, in the studio mode. But yeah, thanks for coming on and be careful out there. And keep us abreast of anything that you're like when your project comes out, when your project comes out. I mean, we could have like both, and we could talk about long-term projects.
Oh, you know, sure.
When it comes out.
Jessica's great at condensing that too, because I've brought her in. So like I told you, the end of the semester for my class, they have 7 weeks to do a long-term project. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to bring Jessica in. She's going to talk.
That's a really good idea, Joe. And it was great to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. There was a podcast about long-term projects and it was like a year, but you guys have been working on this for, you know, hopefully more. So that'll be really interesting, I think, to talk about long-term.
New episodes drop every Tuesday on 10fps.net or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also catch back episodes on WLOI.org, as all episodes are recorded and produced at WLOI Loyola Radio in Maryland.